Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly talk show. I'm Chris McCormack, associate editor at the magazine, and today I'm joined by Chris Clark, who is a writer and curator based in Vienna. Chris was formerly living in Cork for many years, so hopefully we'll also have time to discuss his present work in Austria. I hope so. But first, we are here to discuss his review of the Steirischer Herbst exhibition, which is a yearly festival which takes place in Graz in southern Austria. I wondered if we might begin by offering our listeners, a sense of the festival and how it takes place throughout the city. Because I think maybe I'm guessing many listeners here might not be familiar with the festival and the way you kind of encounter it in the city. I think is interesting. It's alone, so maybe just give some context to the festival itself first, and then we'll talk about the
Yeah,
show.
I'm very happy to, and good to talk with you again, Chris. And just I'll just put out there, in case you hear little background noises, my almost 2-year-old daughter is wandering around here, but she was also in Graz, so you might just want to pipe in with the occasional comment. To give a little bit of background about it, so Steirischer Herbst, or I guess the autumn harvest, or the steer sorry the Styrian harvest, or Styrius autumn. It's a festival that started in 1968. It kind of came out of that post 1960s period of political fervor, and it's retained a bit of that, I think, throughout. It is a mixed festival in that it has a visual art component, and quite a significant one. But it is also a month of theater, of music, of performance. These are all big kind of parts of it as well. Certainly during my visit, I got to kind of get the opening weekend period of it, and the exhibition side. But I should also say that, of course, not living in Graz, there's probably a fair amount that I missed. And so that's so
That's a
this
sort of
year's
backdrop for it.
iteration, again under the directorship of Katharina de Gog, who's been running it, I think, for quite a while now, maybe 10 years or so. It picked up this theme, or the title of Never Again Peace. So again, really kind of touching on the kind of political hot buttons, ideas around kind of Palestine and Ukraine, and of course it's very much grounded in Graz as well. So also that rise of the Freedom Party in Austria as well. So the FPÖ, who have come very close to kind of getting into power. Graz is the second city as a kind of industrial kind of place. I think actually I heard as a socialist government at the time. So there's definitely a leftist working class kind of background to the festival as well.
Good. Yeah, I think what's interesting as well, you talk about, and maybe we'll try and unpick some of the exhibitions and the works that are on show. But again, the title itself, which you just alluded to or just mentioned, Never Again Peace, you talk about a certain kind of pessimism that sort of creeps in through the show. And I wondered, I mean, maybe that's we're jumping ahead a little bit, but I was just interested in how that was evident in some of the works that you encountered during the opening.
Yeah, so I mean, the title itself, Never Again Peace, comes from a 1935 play, a satirical play by Ernst Toller. This is a play in which it kind of imagines Napoleon and Saint Francis of Assisi on the Mount Olympus, and they're kind of having a debate about humankind's propensity for warfare, whether they want peace. And I thought it was also interesting that the curators kind of they talked about its translation, the title of this play being translated into English. It usually gets translated as "No More Peace," but the "Never Again Peace" thing actually also then is an allusion to this idea of never again. When you're talking about things like the Holocaust, so it's quite heavy going in terms of its starting point. As an exhibition, I mean, it is quite a dour exhibition. It's and I think they're quite upfront about that. I mean, certainly during the opening address, they talked about. Yes, never again war, but also never again this idea of never again. How we seem to be in a period where we're kind of moving beyond a push for a more peaceful, more enlightened society, And I think in Austria that's interesting as well. I was having a conversation recently enough, and it kind of came around this idea of kind of investment in green technologies and kind of. And how this was such a big driver of the economy. And of course, now everybody always talks about that money will go to defense. You know, there's a war on the, not quite on the doorstep, but not far away either. And certainly a lot of those budgets are being rerouted. So the conversations around peace seem to be very much kind of put on the back burner.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that is what's interesting, isn't it? This sort of, it made me think about, yeah, as you mentioned, the Holocaust and this notion of the never again being upset by, well, the current, the present predicament, really, which is that those kinds of warnings from the past are no longer there to hold warning signs to the present, I guess. And I guess we're also seeing that evident in some of the works on show. Maybe let's talk about some of the works. You mentioned Candice Bright's work, which I guess feels like a substantial piece within the festival.
Yeah, and the standout I would say as well. It does something that so it's a film called Dear Esther. So it has a quite a strong kind of narrative component in that it picks up on the story of Esther Bejarano, who was sent to Auschwitz as a teenager. I can't remember exactly how old she was, but very young. And part of the way she was able to navigate and survive that was by joining the Mädchen Orchestra, so the girls' orchestra. And she didn't know how to play, or no, I think in the film it says she wanted to play piano, but that role was already taken. So she said she'd play accordion, and didn't know how to play accordion, but somehow was able to improvise this and find this position in the orchestra, which essentially kind of kept her alive, because they had this kind of purpose. And has talked about that thing of having to play for trains coming in with prisoners. I mean, it's kind of really. Quite kind of grueling story. And then when she left, I mean, actually after the war, she moved to Israel, but then left Israel after the Nakba. She was so upset and so turned against what this project had become, and became a campaigner for the rights of Palestinians up until the end of her life. And so the film tells a bit of this story, but it really tells it through Candice Bright herself, who was kind of researching this, who's talking about the current state of politics, and also then starts to learn how to play the accordion herself. So, and she wants to learn how to play the song Bel Ami, which was a favorite of Esther's as well. And so the whole film has this kind of epistolatory kind of sense to it, where she's in dialogue with Esther, but obviously not. She's kind of working through the research and the writings and the story. And it could be trite. I mean, it kind of verges a little bit on this kind of feel-good story, but she really then does this thing that Candice Bright is so fantastic with, and kind of bring in contemporary politics, to bring in things like the far-right push that's happened in Israel in the past few years, they kind of talk about things like Yair Netanyahu being kind of influential, Elon Musk doing the Sag Ha'il during this kind of thing, and how that's all been kind of allowed and has been kind of accepted. So it kind of really plays off Esther not as a essentially just a historical figure, but as someone who has like a lot of contemporary currency as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that. I mean, certainly the softening of our values, and not our values, but let's just say the way in which the right, the rhetoric of the right has become somewhat normalized, in terms of certainly popular media. I guess that's interesting to imagine how Candice Bright has handled that particular kind of moment and how it sits within this, I guess, more historical material. I was just interested to know a little bit how she's kind of woven those things together. Is it found footage that she weaves in, or how does she work?
There's a little bit of found footage, but largely it's her, and she does. There's a couple of interesting things. So she works with a group, and forgive me for not remembering the name of it, but who do a Palestinian group who do this work kind of with poetry with watermelons, where they're spelling out words with watermelons. It's hard to describe the kind of effectiveness of this. So it has this real kind of mix of different kind of tempos, and yes, there's like contemporary footage of things like IPAC or like things like mosque and stuff as well. So it has this kind of mix, and then of course lots of footage of Bright herself learning to play the accordion. So it's a documentary, but with a whole mix of different elements put in there. And it's an interesting thing as well, because I think I was a little bit suspicious maybe going in that so much of the work in the exhibition or in the festival seemed to deal with the past, but it does feel like one of the few pieces that really kind of situates that past from a contemporary perspective.
Right, which is what we're looking for in many ways. I think the Biennales I'm looking at, there is a kind of need to recontextualize the history of the, past histories and kind of give them new momentum. And I think, yeah, it's great to hear that there's something like that happening here in the Storreische Herbst, because sometimes I feel like that's missing sometimes.
But there's also like a bit of a weirdness about it, I think, as well. So obviously Austria, with its own contentious history, to criticize Israel is difficult territory still for people here. There's an inherent conservatism about some of these issues. And so this feels like a way of kind of getting into it, I guess, to kind of, within this work to make that parallel between what's happening now and what was happening then. I would say that if I have an issue, with the festival overall, there's maybe a little bit too much work that delves into the past, the detriment of looking at things that are happening now, and that maybe that's a little bit of a, an attempt to kind of to not address things that are maybe a little bit more contentious.
You mentioned a certain kind of tight-lipped feeling sometimes.
The work itself has, certainly a lot of value, but I mean, a piece by Gelatin, for example, is work, and I'm a fan of their pieces for a long time. And they use the factory, actually. I should say that most of the exhibition is also set within this former Bauer factory. Bauer is a company that made the Jagermeister, as I'm sure your listenership knows. And the factory, of course, has been closed down to the distillery, and they've readapted this for the festival. So again, it's kind of, post-industrial kind of site, as you see in a number of biennials. Gelatin do adapt it in an interesting way, in that they kind of do a one at a time performance piece. So you have to kind of line up and go down these steps, where you are brought into the basement of the factory, and then collected by like a boatman. So that's like underwater part of it, and this kind of boat comes, and this man who's kind of dressed up. So this kind of sense of the river Styx, and you're kind of in the depths of hell. And it's like it's kind of a great moment when you kind of see the boatman arrive. But it does fizzle out a little bit of an experience, because it comes up just about kind of atmosphere and kind of evoking something, without really putting a finger on what exactly it's trying to say.
I see.
And I guess that's, a little bit of an issue that I could have with some of the works, that it kind of skirts around the issue. You have this kind of topic, which I think is a really interesting one, about, this foregoing of an attempt of, this kind of grand arc towards a better world. And some of the work, I think, really just retreats into whimsy, or into kind of historical archival material. And actually, it elides the things that actually are happening all around us. Like, there's very little work, I think, that, with a few exceptions, that deals with the rise of far-right politics, I think, in Austria, for example. More likely they're talking about its past and the things that have happened in the city,50, 60 years ago.
Interesting. I remember actually meeting Ekaterina de Gout. Must have been, well, before COVID, up in Newcastle, we did these series of talks. And I remember finding her incredibly strident and a very, so it's interesting to hear this other perspective in a way, because I think her temperament is very direct. I mean, I remember, fascinating conversations with her about politics at that time. And I guess that would have been the first time that someone like President Trump had got into power, and this sort of initial first wave, I would say, or let's just say the first neo wave that we're sort of recognizing the sort of rise of fascism in our current climate. And yeah, so it's just interesting to sort of see this other perspective of what this particular festival is trying to deliver. I mean, unfortunately, I've actually never been to this festival, so
Now, this is my first time as well.
also, I'm interested to know, I'd be interested to see it more sequentially, like how this sits in previous festival iterations.
Well, it clearly takes, a lot of pride in the fact that it does have a political agenda. And that goes back to, its beginnings in 68, and it seems to have always consistently pursued that. And I guess, to some level, it's how artists negotiate those
For
terms.
sure.
And certainly, I mean, a lot of the work here is political. I just don't know if it's dealing with the right politics. it seems to be dealing with the politics that is maybe less current or less urgent. I mean, there are things, for example, and then also there are kind of gestures that I think that maybe feel, I don't want to say flippant, but they don't really have the same kind of impact. So Ahmed Oud, did this kind of intervention piece where he, the Freiheitsplatz, the Freedom Square, in the center of Graz, where he kind of makes this gesture, where he's renaming it again as Freedom Square. Now it's already known as Freedom Square, but it's kind of symbolic kind of gesture to kind of remind people that, like, this was fought for as a place. This was, I can't remember the name, but it was named after, I guess, the emperor, and Franz Josef, I guess it was before, and had been renamed, Freedom Square, I think, in like 1913, and then also in the 30s as well. So, it is a case that they, you can have political development, but you can also have political decay, as Samuel Huntington pointed out, that things can backtrack, and it's good to kind of be reminded of this stuff. But you can't get away from the fact that this is a very ephemeral kind of gesture. It's invisible to most of the public. It works within a language of kind of conceptual art, institutional critique.
Yeah, for
And
sure.
so on some level, I'm kind of like, well, it's a lovely sentiment. But I wonder if lovely sentiments are so useful in the kind of particular climate.
Very good point. I'd have to come one year and see this festival. I'm really interested. Also, as you point out, I mean, it's been running since 68, so it has a long history. I guess, do we need to talk about any other exhibitions or any works that stand out? I think, I mean, you mentioned Nastio Mosquito, but that's sort of
Yes. I
intriguing.
mean, I don't know if I can do it justice in a way.
It's
So
sort
it
of
was
an
like,
intriguing
it's a,
endpoint, but.
yeah, it's a screening and, or it's a new film that he's made. But it also then during the opening weekend was kind of a performance, and basically a performance in the sense that you're kind of brought through three rooms, and the first room he gives kind of introduction. It has these images. Everything is bathed in red light. He invites you to take a shot of schnapps.
Nice.
So, I mean, it's a press preview, so it's like about 11 o'clock in the morning, but whatever. And then you're brought into a screening room where he shows this new film, which is called They, the Them, Are We, Mono Dialogues. And it's an animation piece that he's done, and it's kind of a funny one. So what I liked about this work, though, is it really deliberately does seem to pick up on the Uwe Stoller Never Again Peace, No More Peace reference, and that within this animation, he's pairing numerous kind of figures, celebrities, historical figures in dialogue with each other. So it has a feel of that kind of Napoleon and Francis of Assisi conversation. But you've got like Madonna talking with John Paul II, or you've got like Nelson Mandela and Hitler in conversation. And all the while they're in this kind of nightclub concert environment where there's like super group, Wombata Express are playing. And it's like got Miles Davis and Bob Marley. And also Nastio Mosquito himself is in this band. And so you watch this thing and they have these kind of conversations which are really, they're more kind of gossipy and kind of, picking at each other. And then every now and then they kind of throw in this disclaimer of like, yeah, but what about, Palestinian children? What about this like kind of thing? And then they kind of go back to their same old nonsense, chit chat. And then at the end, you're brought into this final room after the screening. And I kind of still think this is like very audacious in a way, but like there's a you're introduced to it by the artist as a room, a space of reflection after what you've just seen, and it's full of like mirrors, and it just feels like this like really kind of clear cut thing going like we're also talking about you, but we're also talking about the artist himself. It's as people who are kind of wrapped in this the solipsism almost in a way of just the navel gazing and being invested in their own interests. So it's a real damning moment. I mean, it's not a very, it's not a very friendly moment, I guess, for a lot of, art journalists kind of standing there. But at the same time, I kind of liked that in a way, that it felt like kind of a splash of cold water or something like that after several works that maybe were a bit more worthy. But they didn't have that same kind of impact. You could kind of walk away from them. And this one, yeah, it felt like, yes, we are implicit in these things, and that I think is at the very least is a useful starting point for an exhibition that's going to look at, well, why have we given up on this kind of pursuit of a better, brighter world?
Very good point. And I like the sort of almost confrontational point that you raise, within the work. Well, Chris, I think that's that show. And I just wanted to say, how's it going out in Canada? I mean, I'm intrigued to know how you're finding it. So How you
So
talk
as
about
you can, as
yeah.
you'll be able to hear all through the audio. I've got a little almost 2-year-old here, so that does
Yes.
take a lot of my time up. But I moved here well, we moved here, myself and my partner, and our child moved here in June, living just outside Vienna, actually. So you might see in my byline, I always says I'm based in Vienna, but actually, no one would know where I'm living. It's really in the countryside. It's like
Okay.
900 people, but it's about like 40 minutes away from Vienna.
Yeah.
So it's a place to work and then a place to
Yeah.
retreat. But it's
Beautiful.
nice. I mean, it's beautiful. And there's
Yeah.
obviously, we had our own, before you started the interview, we had you're talking a bit about freeze and how everything has gotten very busy. And Vienna had that in September as well, with
Oh,
the
yeah.
Vienna Contemporary and Parallel and the beginning exhibition season curated by. So it felt like there was a real, after a very quiet August, things got
Yeah.
real busy. And so it's been quite enjoyable, I'd say.
Good. I'm glad to hear you're having a nice time out there. Well, always a pleasure to chat
You
and
too.
discuss the exhibitions that you're looking at. I hope to see you sometime soon. Either I will be in Vienna or in London or wherever we meet.
Definitely, definitely.
Yes. Thank you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers, Chris. Bye.
I'm currently in on Hokkaido in Japan, in this park designed by Noguchi, where there's this huge, strange glass pyramid that Noguchi designed, that there's my friends just performed at, and
Right.
I just walked up. I'm sitting sort of in the
This
night
is
time
your current
in the sort
situation.
of forest. That's where I'm at currently, yeah.
I wish we could all show where you are, but yeah, sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. Well, I'm in London town, so that's where I am, looking at, well, my computer screen. So, well, thanks so much for joining the show and being on it. I'll just quickly introduce you and what we're about to discuss. So, Toja Leonarska is a writer and curator based in London and Warsaw, although presently, as she's just mentioned, in Japan. And she's covered a really interesting exhibition in Riga for us, Survival Kit House of Seymour, and that's Seymour SEE hyphen MORE. This is Survival Kit 16. So obviously there's been several other iterations. So maybe it's important just to give some backdrop to the festival itself and how it takes place in the city of Riga. That would be great to hear.
Yeah, so it as I was told, the festival it started in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis,
Yeah.
and the name Survival Kit reflects that in terms of organizing exhibitions in Riga in spaces that were previously office spaces or commercial units that were gone out of business in the context of the financial crisis. And also, I imagine there being, no funding for the arts in that period, and so doing larger scale exhibitions in DIY way with a minimal budget. I believe that's how the festival started. Everything has changed in in the past 16 years as it ran every year. It is now in this edition. So every year it was hosted in different places,
Okay.
and this time it was in again this kind of commercial space otherwise, but it kind of to me it reflected the gentrification and the economic growth of the Baltics, because it was in a kind of like swanky building. I would say it was this like new development. The vibe was kind of like maybe co-working space, department store, but then repurposing an old industrial building. So it had both that kind of I don't know. Well, as you're speaking from London, it had a very kind of hackneyed gentrification vibe going there. But to me, it felt like that. If anything, that reflects if this exhibition series kind of was responding to the economic state of the country, then even more so, a gentrified place now makes
Yeah.
sense for that,
But is the building still empty? I'm guessing it is, even if it is a gentrified. Is it what's going to happen, or what is happening to this building? Is it empty for reasons between businesses? Why is it currently being occupied by these artworks?
I'm actually not sure. I think that so some of the units were offices or businesses.
Okay.
And I think that the spaces maybe were in a kind of pre-rented area. Maybe it's something
Okay.
that, you know, that will become something else later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this year's festival has been curated by Slabs and Taters, alongside another artist, Payam Shafiri and Kasia.
No, so
Sorry.
Payam Shafir and Kasia Kotrek are both, that's who Slavs and Tatars
Sure.
are.
Yeah.
And then they co-curated this together with Michał Grzegorzik, who's a curator from Warsaw.
Thank you for clarifying. So
Mm-hmm.
they've curated this year's iteration. Could you say, because in a way you talk a bit about the kinds of interests and directions that they take, and I think that's quite a useful beginning point. So just say what their kind of their sort of curatorial agenda of this collective is.
Yeah, totally. So I think for Slavs and Tatars, they're sort of one line, you know, elevator pitch curatorial concept is almost like a you know, half joking. It's that their focus is anything between the east of the Berlin Wall and the west of the Great Wall of China, which in itself is a kind of sort of mocking attitude of the fact that obviously that's you know, too vast of a focus, and it more kind of points to the exclusion of that area of you know, Eastern Europe, Western Asia, Central Asia, and East Asia, in a lot of the discourse in the art world when they started, which was, I believe, in the early 2000s, pre 2010. And Michał Grzegorzik, he focuses on performance and in the context often of queerness and excess.
Okay.
That's kind of, yeah,
And
that's
these, in a way, it's quite an interesting pairing, and maybe not one that on paper would be an obvious one. Maybe just say a little bit. I know we're not going to keep much of our conversation is going to be quite short, but I would just interested to kind of pick up some of the works that you mention and the kind of mood of the show, really, which often sounds quite, let's say, comical, carnivalesque, as some words that you use here, but maybe just give a brief outline of some of the kinds of exhibition or the works that were on show. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, so I think what I really liked about it was that I was looking forward to seeing an exhibition that uses somewhat, let's say, like a different currency that a lot of the exhibitions I've been seeing recently in the West, and a kind of currency that's less like self-serious and a vocabulary that kind of pulls from different references, but also something that can be really play with the simple and the banal, and they do that with humor. And I think that was a lot of the curatorial thought behind this was that I know that Slavs and Tatars work with that kind of thing of wanting to make exhibitions that, as they say, they can take like an uncle or, you know, someone who's, let's say, their Syrian uncle who's a dentist who can like grasp the exhibition. And I felt that there were a lot of the works were kind of almost like puns or jokes, but there were also, you know, there's humor and there's seriousness in the humor, and then there's, you know, there's depth in the surface and there's depth in the banal. Some of the, to me, like really great ones were, for example, the performances. There was a performance program for the opening where, for example, the Polish queer performer Filip Garutkowska did a kind of almost like a burlesque drag stand-up routine where she had a like a skirt suit remade after Margaret Thatcher and delivered the Margaret Thatcher's speech of there is no such thing as society, but rewrote it to be there is no such thing as gender. and then performed it with this really heavy Polish accent and a kind of in a kind of like really like excess like over the top really. And it was generally just like I was really just entertained. I mean, it's obviously it was so silly, but it was just like, yeah, this is just really entertaining the way that like a stand-up routine is entertaining.
Yeah. It sounds great,
And
actually, to be fair. It does sound kind of great.
yeah, and then there was this puppet, hand puppet theater by the artist Cai Xinhao, who based this kind of almost like a musical puppet theater piece. It was based on the directive of Mao, like Maoist era propaganda that was against pests. Had this huge program of the eradication of pests in Maoist China, and she kind of staged this musical theater dialogue between like all the different pests that were meant to be eradicated and all the symbols for which they stood in contrast to like the purity of humans. And
That's
so,
great.
and that was kind of in a, it was almost like it could be, you know, spoken to the at a level of like a child. But then the setup of the theater looked like something that could be either like the lining of your throat or your anus, and you know, but also could be theater curtains. So there was a lot of that kind of both visual and sort of symbolic, you know, two-facedness of everything.
It just sounds actually kind of great to me. I mean, I. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of spiritedness that sounds that's what's really shoots through, or you know, it seems like that's what's threaded through this event and exhibition, really, which holds a different kind of, let's just say, energy than maybe you might find, I don't know, in London or something. I don't know. It just seems like there's a kind of ribaldic kind of humor that's both point politically pointed, but also kind of, yeah, brazen in a way of trying to like. Both hook the audience in and also trying to articulate some kind of an agenda. But
Yeah, totally. And I think, oh yeah.
sorry, I was going to ask you, is there any final thoughts you might have? I mean, I know you mentioned who I think is a wonderful artist, Shadi Habib Allah, who I think is an incredible artist and is not seen enough, in my view. Maybe
Oh,
briefly
totally.
mentioning his
Yeah.
work. Yeah.
Yeah. So his work was an incredible one that was, yeah, because some of the works were really serious and they might have been simple gestures, let's say, but they were. Yeah, but as Payam actually has said in some interviews, like it's, you know, there's depth in the surface and there's depth in the simplicity of a gesture there. And so yeah, his work, our last work was of sculptures that are kind of hollowed out huts of transparent plastic packaging of drinks like water bottles, you know, the kind of the sort of transparent plastic covering that like a set of, I don't know, 10 bottles together. And they glisten in the light and they look like kind of ghosts. And they have a kind of scary kind of like a presence of an absence of I don't know, dispossession. And they're actually taken from grocery shops that are run by Arab immigrants in Detroit, in areas that are food deserts that are mostly populated by a kind of, you know, underserved Black communities who do not have access to like fresh food in these areas, which is obviously like, you know, a result of like urban development and yeah, like these policies that underserve these communities. And then you have this, because of that, you have this kind of idea of the state or the nation as something really pluralistic, where like, you know, there's no thinking of the country or like the US of like as any kind of monolith, because there's so much sort of political fragmentation, identitarian fragmentation of like, you know, all of these sort of transnational connections of like, you know, this Palestinian artist making works about these communities who are served by immigrants, and obviously the US as a state having policies that are against each of these groups. So it was that was a really powerful work, and I agree about that that Allah has is not seen enough in exhibitions and in general, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thanks so much, Toja, for that brief overview, and also for taking the time out of your schedule while you're traveling.
Thank
It's much appreciated, and really
you
thank
so
you for
much.
writing this great article, and it's in this month's issue of Art Monthly, so do take a read if you can. Thanks again, Tosha.
Thank you so much, Chris. This was lovely. Thank you.
And now I welcome Virginia Wiles, who is an art historian, critic, and author, and has kindly reviewed Mona Hatoum at the Barbican, who's paired alongside Alberto Giacometti. The show sort of brings together, or invites rather, numerous artists or different artists to respond to Alberto Giacometti's work. And in this instance, we see Mona Hatoum sort of working alongside or building connections between her work and Alberto Giacometti. I wondered if we could begin by sort of trying to outline or give some sense of where these quite diverse or divergent artists, certainly backdrop or background, might align. And I think this, I know where this lands, but I just want to kind of give you the opportunity to describe where they do combine, come together as two artists.
Well, they come together very much through their treatment of their object as theatrical. Hers is very ambiguous and very and yet open, and his is also ambiguous but very closed. So, that's what makes it so extraordinary and mysterious, really.
Yeah, and I guess we know both their works in very different ways. I think, on one hand, as well, I mean, I would imagine there's certain points around conflict as well that sort of stem biographically through both their works. One being, you know, Giacometti born out the ashes in many senses out the post-war, you know, climate or history of, the post-war era, and in a way. You know, Mona Hatoum, someone that has very clearly and directly been influenced about her background, both in Lebanon, but also more broadly, conflict globally and around the Middle East. And so, in a way, these two very perhaps divergent on paper histories also come together, as you're saying, in these more as elliptical and nuanced and mysterious ways, I would say, in both the works. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, I agree. She's suffered a lot, as you know. One of her the works that I describe is really shows it. You know, the sort of ones with burnt wood and so has he suffered a lot. You can see a lot of the feelings of the sort of lost soul man walking alone and humanly lost. And I think that's where there are a lot of links, not only emotionally but formally in their work. So, but then there's also the odd touch of humor which relieves it really.
Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit about how that humor is manifested in their works?
Well, I think it's when she with her object, so she actually is sort of morbid humor like his really, and that she has soap with little nails in it and lots of other sort of amputated bits of bodies on the shelves and he's got well, it's not so obvious his humour, but it's there somehow. There's a little sense of it. It's in the background.
Yeah,
As he
I think certainly in his work more broadly, I don't know necessarily all the works represented in this show, but one can think of there's certainly the surrealist tendencies in his work, mirroring some degree of the absurdity of human nature, for sure. You mentioned, I guess, It'd be interesting to see, because in a way, like one of the more extreme works actually is where Mona has installed one of his works inside one of his, there's one of her works inside one of his works. Can you describe
Yes.
that? It's quite an extreme presentation.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, it's quite cheeky, really, and it's sort of like got the nose coming out of the space and looking around. No, it's very funny, that one. So there is humor in both. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, just give a sense of how actually, I'll just describe it. It's sort of a one of works by Mona, which is kind of like a cage-like space. Isn't that right? And then within that,
Yeah.
she's suspended. Is it, it's his nose work, isn't it? Isn't it
Yeah.
his nose, Giacometti's nose, the figure or the mask or that sort of has this very elongated snout. Is that
Yeah.
correct? Yeah.
No, there's a comic character with a long nose. What's his name?
Yeah.
I can't remember the name, but anyway, she's in that. Yeah.
Great.
No, it's the cage idea which
Yeah.
keeps coming backwards and forwards, and it's sort of like imprisonment and exile and separation and yeah, just sort of like half brutal and half quite funny, really. Yeah.
The thing, isn't it? I mean, absurdity of the situation, I think, has to come into focus a little bit when we're looking at such devastation,
Yeah.
in times of war. I think also she's included an early video work of hers, which I'm sure many listeners will be familiar with. But I think it'd be it's. I was actually pleased to see that it was installed here or included in this show. Just describe it because I think it's such a great. Work of hers.
Yes, she's walking in Brixton with boots behind her, tied onto her, and the boots are walking. The boots are back to front, and she's walking forward very slowly. And no, that's one of the strongest pieces, really, because it's one of the oldest and the one that you remember the most.
It's one of her most distinctive works, I would think, that she's made for sure. Along, of
Yeah.
course, I mean, one always thinks of Mona Hatoum and the installations that she's made too. You know, the sort of oversized sort of cheese graters and these sort of objects of terror and yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, this show had a rather, it didn't show that much around her hair balls, for example. I mean, the balls of hair that and this I felt, you know, it concentrated more on the tougher side of her work, the sort of sense of exile and yeah. Not the gentler side, the gentler comes in.
But I guess in a way, it's more about the conversation that's occurring, obviously, between both Hatoum and Giacometti here, that's actually driving the story and how that's being manifested. I guess, you know, often in these sort of where two artists are presented, it can often feel like two competing forces. But, you know, certainly when in the case such as these, where one artist has died or is certainly historicized. And we have one
Yeah.
living artist. It can often feel, you know, an awkward. It can sometimes feel like an awkward fit. But here, it seems like certainly the way that you review it, it feels a very successful and nuanced pairing.
Yeah, I thought it was. I thought it really opened eyes up to the possibility of both sides of it being at once absurd and yet tragic, really. That's why, as somebody said, he was already existentialist before his time, Giacometti, is sort of like the daftness of living. What's the point of living? And yet, at the same time, the humor of living, the importance of laughing and enjoying life. So,
Yeah, there's something, there's such a, I think of Giacometti similarly within that. So there's a kind, there's a sort of harsh kindness, I suppose. There's sort of a truth that is both kind and unsettling. And I guess in a way that's where we can often think of Mona Hatoum too as an artist. She kind of wrestles with this almost chilly or almost threatening forms of domestic imagery. I think you
I think
described, you
it's
know.
a very, I think it's a very, very suitable exhibition to show now with what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on up there. And that's what why it made me think a lot more because of Palestine and her link with Palestine and yeah.
Does this work actually actively state? It's Palestinian position.
Oh, yeah, I think she does really. And you know, that's why it's in a way subtle, discreet, but at the same time it's there. There's that strength of you know, her force of her formal and her intellectual ideas comes through. And yeah, and I'm just wondering whether to go on the march tomorrow.
I know. No, and also whether to wear the actual pro action statement that would get you arrested, I suppose. I know. It's crazy times we live in, Virginia, for sure.
Yes, it
But
really
the
is.
idea that we can get now arrested for displaying a simple sign. I know. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining. And I encourage all our listeners to go see this exhibition and also importantly to read Virginia's review, which is in the current issue of the magazine. Virginia, thank you so much for joining this afternoon. And it's always a pleasure to hear you and to see you, if we're briefly. Okay, many thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.